Hi, this is Ken Shropshire. I'm here with Karen Given, who's joined us again for another, what I believe will be fantastic podcast and conversation. And we just want to have a little preamble for you to let you know what it's all about. We got the title, No More Crumbs, Equity in Women's Basketball. Karen, welcome and tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, so the idea behind this episode is to track the fight from sort of where it started with Title IX and teams just coming into existence with scholarships for players to sort of last spring when it really exploded with March Madness, or maybe not called March Madness, the women's tournament, and the photos of the gym that was just a couple of yoga mats and some dumbbells. So we're going to kind of track that fight because I think for a lot of people involved in this fight for a long time, those photos were nothing new. But I think for the general public to see it so starkly displayed was really very interesting.
So Karen, as usual, you go beyond the data that we pulled together, looking at the stats of women as head coaches in women's basketball in college. Spoiler alert, there are still a lot of men that are leading these teams, and
right.
Intersectionality is a problem as well with the absence of African-American women. Who did you talk to in this first episode?
Well, so I've talked to Muffet McGraw, who, as you know, was a longtime coach at Notre Dame. She is feisty and fun. I've also talked to Danielle Donahue. She's the executive director of the Women's Basketball Coaches Association, and they are working with the NCAA to deal with some of these inequities. And then I'm also talking to Marianne Stanley, who sort of was the first very public victim of this fight back in the 90s when she asked for equal pay to her male colleagues and was denied and fired.
Yeah, as a sports lawyer, my true calling, she brought one of the first major lawsuits in this area. It was just very interesting. And it really got to these issues of parity and equity, and how do you determine who gets paid what for doing the same work?
Right.
Well, thank you, Karen. And everybody, enjoy. Maybe that's the right word. I don't know. No More Crumbs, Equity in Women's Basketball. Thank you.
Thank you.
In her 33 seasons as head women's basketball coach at Notre Dame, Muffet McGraw had success few could imagine. 2 national championships, 9 visits to the Final Four, and in 2017, she was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. But her tenure did not have an auspicious start.
One of my first meetings, the men's assistant coach came in and said, "Here's how it works. We practice when we want, for as long as we want, and then you guys can have the gym." And I thought, wow, this is my first week on the job. You know, I don't want to know if I'm going to fight that battle just yet. The men would say, like, "We're off to Marquette. We're flying. But first, we're going to have a steak dinner." And, you know, we were driving and stopping at McDonald's.
But when Muffet compares those early days coaching at Notre Dame to her own college experience, she says it was like night and day.
Wore your own clothes to practice and you did your own laundry at home. You bought your own sneakers. We drove ourselves to the games. I mean, we say, like, "Ooh, who can drive tomorrow?" We sat there and waited for the guys to finish practice. Then the JV would go on, and then the women would get to take the court.
Muffet played college basketball in the years immediately following Title IX, the landmark legislation that grants men and women equal access to education and sports. And she says her and her teammates didn't complain about how they were treated.
We couldn't have been happier. And it always reminds me of, I'm reading Billie Jean King's book right now, and she talks about how we got the crumbs and we were happy to have them. We have a team. Isn't this great? We get to compete. We get to play.
After graduation, Muffet took a high school coaching job. She says the pay wasn't enough to live off for a month, let alone a year. So she worked odd jobs to supplement her income. When the head coaching job at Notre Dame opened up in 1987, Muffet was coaching at Lehigh.
I loved it there. Yeah, I was there for a long time. But when Notre Dame opened, my husband was the one that kept saying, you got to send in your resume. And I was like, I'm never going to get that job. Typical woman, right? We always look at the things that we're not going to do well. And so when I finally got the call to go interview, I mean, that was a thrill, just getting on the plane and heading to South Bend and trying to familiarize ourselves with what are their colors? What, you know, where is South Bend? And so when they called back and offered me the job, I was so excited. You know, I just hung up the phone. And of course, my husband, one of his first questions was, how much are they paying you? And I was like, holy shoot, I forgot to ask. I was so excited to get the job.
I mean, talk about, you know, Billie Jean's right. We're just happy with the crumbs, right?
Yeah, we really are. We got to change that.
When she finally heard how much she was being paid, Muffet was happy with the offer.
Yeah, it was more than I was making at Lehigh. Not a lot more, but it was more. You know, I was not going to turn it down. I probably would have paid them, you know, to have the opportunity.
But soon after Muffet took the job at Notre Dame, other women's college basketball coaches would start to demand more. Muffet remembers watching their cases.
I remember Marianne Stanley was one of the first. I think it was USC. She was suing for a better salary.
The year was 1993, and the story doesn't begin with a lawsuit. It begins with a negotiation, one that Marianne Stanley planned and prepared for.
I knew that I was going to have to sit down and talk with the athletic director about moving forward.
That's Marianne.
And so prior to doing that, I went to visit with George Raveling, who at the time was the men's head coach at USC. We were talking about compensation, and I said, well, you know the lay of the land. We pretty much do the same job, and so I just want to know what your approach was. And he said, honestly, I said, yeah, just tell me how you approached this. And he said, I lay awake at night and think of every possible way they can compensate me outside of salary, and I ask for it. And I was pretty stunned. I was like, really? He's like, yeah, I think of everything, and that's what I asked for. I'm like, okay.
Marianne also talked to Tara Vanderveer, head coach at Stanford. Tara had recently negotiated for pay equal to her male counterpart, and she helped Marianne talk through making a case for moving towards gender equity, not all at once, but over the life of her next contract.
So those two separate conversations led me to the point where I actually walked in the office to meet with Mike Garrett. Basically, I told him that, you know, myself and George Raveling did the same job, exactly the same job, same duties, same responsibilities, pretty much using the language of Title IX, which states if you do the same job with the same duties, responsibilities, et cetera, you should get paid equally. And Mike, the entire time, is nodding his head. Okay, to everything I said.
But while George and Marianne did the same jobs, there was a lot that was different. When Marianne was hired at USC, the team was coming off a losing record. Marianne was told that she was expected to win a championship. No such pressure was put on George. In her second year on the job, Marianne took USC to the NCAA tournament. In her third year, they made the Elite Eight, and she had recruited the best player in women's college basketball at the time, Lisa Leslie. And she did all of this with fewer resources than had been provided to George Raveling.
So, for example, I had secretarial help, but had to share that staff with six or seven other coaches of different sports. Where the men's basketball coach doing the exact same work, the exact same calendar, the exact same everything, has not only his own secretary, but secretarial staff for his assistants.
So Marianne concedes her tenure as head college basketball coach was not exactly the same as George's.
In fact, I was doing it with less support than George, with less resources than George, more successfully than George.
But Marianne knew asking for equal pay was going to be a hard sell, so she got creative. Her daughter was about to start college at USC. Her tuition was already covered by the university, but Marianne said if the college were to cover her daughter's room and board as well, she'd count that toward her total compensation.
Like, however you want to do it, I'm willing to work with you. But it's not right to have me doing the exact same job and get paid a fraction of what I ought to be paid. And the whole time, like, you're nodding right now, you affirm and understand. That's what I was getting the whole time for about 45 minutes in the meeting. So I left that meeting feeling and understanding that he was in agreement, that I did the same job with the same responsibilities and even with greater expectations and less resources would doing a better job. And he would get back to me regarding the contract in writing. So fast forward about, a week or two later, I get a contract that doesn't look anything like what we discussed.
When you opened up that contract and it was nothing like what you expected it to be, I mean, what was your reaction? Were you shocked?
Yeah, my heart sank. Yeah, my heart sank. Because, sorry. Yeah, I didn't come there to lose. I came there to win. I came there to restore a program to what it had been. And willing to accept what that meant in terms of the demands and the rigor and the pressure and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that was okay. But don't expect all of that and turn around and tell me you're going to pay me a fraction of what you should. Just do the right thing. So, yeah, when I saw that, my heart sank.
The contract Marianne received from USC that day left no room for negotiation. It was take it or leave it.
And it explicitly at the end of it was, you know, you've got X amount of time to make a decision on this. So, you know, it's kind of putting a gun to your head, like, okay, well, you're not giving me much of a choice here.
I was going to say, was there any part of you that was like, oh, I'll just sign, my daughter's going to school here, you know?
No, because I wanted my daughter to be able to look at me and say, Mom, you did the right thing. And you stood up.
So Marianne didn't sign the contract. Instead, she filed a lawsuit against her employer. She knew it wouldn't be easy.
I was out front, you know. I just couldn't see accepting crumbs off the table when you're telling me I got to win a championship and I got to do it with less staff, less money, less everything. And don't complain.
Marianne filed her lawsuit in state court, but less than a day later, USC filed a motion to move the matter to federal court because Title IX is a federal statute. Marianne was told she had two choices. If she wanted her lawsuit to be heard in state court, where she felt like she had a good chance of winning, she'd need to drop the Title IX language. Or she could accept that the lawsuit would be heard in federal court.
And of course, for me, the whole point was the Title IX protections and the Title IX provisions that say equal work deserves equal pay. So I elected to keep the suit in federal court, which I knew was going to be difficult because it's a lot more conservative landscape in federal court than in state court. Would have been a lot easier just to stay in state court and get paid a bunch of money, you know, to do the job, but that's not why I filed it.
For refusing to sign the contract she was offered, Marianne was fired by USC, and the search for her next job took on extra significance.
I had to prove to the court that there was real damage to me. So I decided that I was going to apply not only for every Division I women's coaching job that came available. I applied for every Division II, Division III, men's and women's coaching jobs.
Marianne sent out more than 120 resumes and cover letters. She got exactly two phone interviews and zero job offers. I won't get into all the twists and turns of Marianne's lawsuit. It was appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, but the court turned it down. And instead, the final appeal was heard by the Ninth District Court of Appeals.
And of the three-judge panel, the lead judge, Judge Pregerson, he got it totally and explicitly said there's discrimination here. It's clear. The other two justices said that no, there wasn't. And so we lost on appeal 2-1.
Marianne lost her lawsuit. But when she was hired for her next coaching job at Cal in 1996, her base pay was equal to that of the men's coach.
Any of the perks or other stuff had to be negotiated. And, you know, I didn't have a problem with that. But anything that had to do with wasn't just the salary, but the treatment of the players and the treatment of the program was going to be the same.
Over the years, Marianne watched as other women's college basketball coaches brought similar lawsuits against their universities.
Well, it's hard, and I could understand, and I, you know, reached out to some of them, you know, because I know how hard it is. You feel like you're out there alone, and it was not easy. It's still not easy. You can see that. Talking about it is not easy.
Yeah. But it doesn't sound like you have any regrets.
No, I don't. Every time I would see somebody get a pay raise or, you know, somebody got the first $1 million contract, I'm like, right on. That's great. That's terrific. That's the way it should be. And to see, you know, the tournament expand and, you know, just all the good things that have come. It's a shame that it's had to take so long, but it's good.
But Muffet McGraw says not every women's college basketball coach was willing to take the risks that Marianne took. In fact, most didn't.
We settled for a lower salary. We settled for less. And most women at that point were thinking, you know, when I get good, when I start to have some success, then I'm going into the AD's office and I'm going to demand equal pay or equal opportunity or whatever it was. But we rarely get there because as women, we're waiting, like when I get to the Final Four, but so few teams actually ever get there. And that's a terrible way to think. So I remember being at practice in the arena, something happened, the men got something and we didn't. And I looked at my team and I thought, if I don't start fighting for this, what are they gonna learn? What are they gonna think that women are supposed to be treated this way? So that's when I decided, man, I gotta make a move. And I wasn't gonna do it about me. You know, then I went to HR and I said, you know, I don't know if this is right, but my team is more successful and my assistant coaches make half of what the men are making, you know, and our team needs this. And what can we do about that?
Muffet says Notre Dame listened to her concerns and over time made a lot of changes to bring equity to the women's program. And so for many years, Muffet McGraw was not a coach who was known for making waves about gender equity.
You know, I was always speaking privately about it, but I think I was so into my own job of like, I'm going to get this program going. I'm going to do this. But we had Pat Summitt, who spoke for all of us. And she was the voice of women's basketball that everyone listened to because she was interested in furthering the game, not furthering Tennessee.
Pat Summitt was the head coach at Tennessee from 1974 to 2012. And she did a lot to further the sport of women's college basketball.
Well, that is a question that I could talk for days on. Pat did so much.
That's Danielle Donahue. She's the executive director of the Women's Basketball Coaches Association.
I would say just because your podcast has a certain time limit, I'm going to try to be as succinct as I can be, but that's very difficult. What I saw in Pat was an unwavering commitment to force the sport forward.
Danielle first met Pat Summitt when she was just a sophomore in high school.
One of my very best friends, her name was LaShonda Stevens, and she was a tremendous player. And we became great friends.
LaShonda was being recruited by Tennessee. And when she went on one of her unofficial visits, Danielle went with her.
And Pat took me back into a back part of the locker room, just her and I, and we sat on two stools. And she said to me, Danielle, I want to be very clear with you. I am very interested in LaShonda being part of my team. And I want you to know I do not have a place for you. I do think highly of you. I like you. I wish you well, but I do not want you to have any misperceptions of my interest. And I want you to know that I want you to be very successful, but I do not have a place for you at Tennessee. Well, Pat was the only coach through the recruiting process who was that painfully honest. And I appreciate her honesty. It hurt. It stung, of course. I mean, I was like, I'm only a sophomore. I can get better.
LaShonda did end up playing for Pat Summitt. Danielle earned a scholarship to Georgia Tech. But during the summers, Danielle would meet LaShonda in Knoxville, and they'd work as camp counselors at Tennessee.
As time got closer to my graduation date, That last time I was a camp counselor, I actually asked Pat, I said, hey, would you ever consider me as a graduate assistant? And she said, oh, Danielle, you know, thanks for bringing that up. And I, you know, I don't have a place for you right now, but I'll keep you in mind. And I thought, well, I've heard that before. Okay, no problem.
Danielle prepared to go to grad school at Georgia Tech. She was planning to continue her studies in industrial and systems engineering.
And I got a phone call one day from Pat while I was driving. I almost drove off the road, and she said, hey, Danielle, this is Pat Summit. And I thought, oh my gosh, hi, you know, how did you get my phone number and why are you calling me? And she said, I don't know how all of this happened, but I now have a position that has opened up, and I'd like to know if you'd like to be my graduate assistant. And I did not even hesitate. And that was the beginning of just a wonderful time in my life, a really magical time in my life.
While working at Tennessee, Danielle got the chance to see Pat's commitment to advancing the women's game up close. Danielle was in charge of handling the team's game schedule.
Every time we ever talked about any sort of game, any matchup that we were putting together, Pat's first thought was, is there an ability for this matchup to be on television? And if it was, Pat was willing to play the game at any time, anywhere, you name it, Pat would be there. And if the television folks would say, hey, we'd like to come into your locker room, or hey, we'd like to put a microphone on you, or hey, we'd like to come to your practice, or hey, she would say, it's wide open. We'd love for you to see anything you want to see. And please, you're welcome to be here.
Pat Summit saw all of this as an opportunity to raise the status, not of women's basketball at Tennessee, but of women's college basketball in general. She fought for change, and she taught others to do the same. So Danielle says, in 2012, when Pat unexpectedly retired after being diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, she did not leave a void.
No. Pat prepared. I believe Pat was such a great example throughout her career that she taught others, and she allowed others to not be afraid to speak their truths also. And so as Pat retired, I do not believe that there was a void. I believe that the game was prepared to take the next step, to take the baton and to continue driving forward.
For Muffet McGraw, Pat Summit's retirement was a call to action, but being more outspoken on gender equity wasn't exactly her idea.
And I remember my athletic director telling me, Jack Swarbrick said, I think it's time for you to start using your voice. And I was like, dang. Oh, okay. let me start working on that.
A few years later, Muffet McGraw would speak out in a way that people are still talking about today.
Oh my gosh. Well, in 2019, when we were in the Final Four and I was the only female head coach and I had an all-female staff, they started asking me questions about it. Why do you have all women? You know, why don't you? Like, dumb questions as the media can do sometimes. And, you know, I thought it was obvious, like, we're a women's team.
Well, I mean, it became a big, huge deal, and you had to address it at the Final Four. I mean, did you go into that press conference saying, I'm going to give a speech now that people are going to be talking about for the next years?
No, I definitely did not do that. In fact, I think I was just so tired of the question. And, you know, there's a little bit of stress being in the Final Four. And I was like, God, how long are we going to have to talk about this? And really, when I looked around the country, because 2018 was such a pivotal year in politics for women, so many more women ran for office. We had so many more women win the elections and get into office. And I was so excited about that. And then I looked at the percentages and I was like, oh, so we're still only 25% and we've had this banner year, you know, and then you start looking at female CEOs and how many women are on the boards of Fortune 500 companies. And, you know, I just started looking into some of those things. So I had all these numbers in my head and it just all came pouring out.
I'm getting tired of the novelty of the first female governor of this state, the first female African-American mayor of this city. When is it going to become the norm instead of the exception? We don't have enough female role models. We don't have enough visible women leaders. We don't have enough women in power. Girls are socialized to know when they come out, gender roles are already set. Men run the world. Men have the power. Men make the decisions. It's always the men that is the stronger one. And when these girls are coming out, who are they looking up to tell them that that's not the way it has to be? And where better to do that than in sports?
After years of speaking privately about gender equity, Moffitt McRae brought the issue to the Final Four, college basketball's biggest stage. And things were starting to look up. More women's coaches fought for and earned equal pay. And Marianne Stanley, now head coach for the WNBA's Indiana Fever, was pleased with the progress the sport was making.
I'm not going to sit here and say everybody had the right attitude about equity at that time, but it started to change and it kept getting better and better. And I say that because you know, and we all know about the lack of equity that was exposed in the sunlight that was shown on the lack of equity at the NCAA tournament a year ago.
I got something to show y'all. So for the NCAA March Madness, the biggest tournament in college basketball for women, this is our weight room. Let me show y'all the men's weight room.
We got a couple of free weights sitting over here, and then we got the Taj Mahal over here, and they're supposed to be comparable. No, they're not, and we're not taking it. Pictures are pictures. You know, the video's telling the truth. Like the curtain was drawn. I think of the Wizard of Oz. You know, you got the scary old guy until you pull the curtain, and it's a little fat, bald dude sitting back there. It's something that if you ask any women's basketball coach who's been at it for a minute, there's nobody surprised by that. But I think the depth to which, you know, the inequity really existed was disappointing. I won't say shocking, but it didn't shock, but it was disappointing for sure. It was institutional. And so the institution has to change. And those things don't change overnight. It's like moving a glacier.
You know, I was tired. I remember tweeting something about being like, I am just so tired of this because we have been fighting this battle for 50 years. Title IX turns 50 this year, and we are still fighting those same battles. And years ago when I was playing, we would have said, wow, look at that. They gave us some weights. Isn't that great? We're thrilled with that. And this generation of women is saying, are you kidding me? That is not nearly enough. We expect more.
When Moffitt McRae looks around the NCAA landscape, she sees a lot that needs to change.
When you look at their structure, the women's vice president in charge of basketball reports to the men's VP in charge of basketball. So structurally, you're already saying women aren't as important as men. I think that just takes like an eraser, you know, and draw the line going in a different direction to the president. That's something obvious.
After inequities were exposed last spring, the NCAA commissioned the law firm Kaplan, Heckler & Fink to conduct a review. Their report found significant disparities between men's and women's experiences at NCAA championships, and they made more than 24 recommendations for changes that would help address those inequities.
You look at what the NCAA has done about it in 6 months. They said we could use March Madness. That's the only thing that they did. Didn't cost them a penny. And they have not done any of the other things.
But in her role as the executive director of the Women's Basketball Coaches Association, Danielle Donahue takes a more measured view, especially given the challenges the NCAA faced in holding two simultaneous major tournaments during a pandemic.
It was an enormous accomplishment to even have the tournaments. Now let's fast forward. There were inequities. I think being in this sport as long as I have been, it's important to point out that what happened in San Antonio didn't just happen in San Antonio. There have been inequities for years. The San Antonio experience just brought them to the forefront in such a powerful way that it was amazing to me the social backlash and outcry when those inequities came to light, right? And that was what was so encouraging to our coaches, to our board. We found ourselves in a moment where differences were not being accepted. And we knew that this was a moment that was special.
Danielle and the WBCA saw those photos and videos coming out of the men's and women's tournaments not as a tragedy, but as an opportunity.
In about 48 hours, we built a website called OurFairShot.com. And so when you go to the website, you will see a side-by-side comparison in lots of different ways.
The website lists everything from differences in swag bags at the NCAA tournament to the way the NCAA sells marketing and TV rights for the women's games. But a lot of it boils down to this. The women's game is undervalued, undersupported, and undercelebrated. But as a member of the NCAA Women's Basketball Oversight Committee, Danielle sees reason to be optimistic.
There are, you know, over 20 recommendations from the Kaplan Hecker Fink Gender Equity Report. And many of those recommendations, they have been sent out to 19 different NCAA committees for review and then to determine what the appropriate action is going to be. We're not over the goal line yet, but we are a part of many very promising conversations. And so we are staying optimistic. We're staying very positive. We are staying encouraged that this is our time and this is our moment. And we are going to help get the sport to a more equitable and equal footing.
And even though getting the NCAA to move is, as Marianne Stanley says, like moving a glacier, it is happening. The NCAA no longer has a choice because this generation of women isn't going to settle for crumbs. Muffet McGraw has seen that firsthand.
And it was funny, we were in the arena practicing one day and they were putting these pom-poms out on the seats because there was a men's game that night. And the girls were like, "Coach, are we getting pom-poms? Do you see what they're doing for the men? We better talk about this." It's like, yay, that's exactly right.
Did you get pom-poms?
We did. We absolutely, but we already knew we were going to. So it was funny that they asked.
Sometimes the pace of change is frustratingly slow. But it really does seem like, in so many ways, we're at an inflection point, a moment in time when real change can happen. Next week on the show, we'll ask the question, how do we make a lasting move toward equity, or dare I say, equality, in women's basketball?
This special was produced by Karen Given. Keep it right here on the Global Sport Matters podcast feed next Thursday for part two of No More Crumbs, and be sure to subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to get notified whenever a new episode arrives. This special from Karen Given is part of our November digital issue, Taking Charge in Women's Basketball, which explores the lives and careers of women coaches, as well as the state of women's college basketball today. You can find it at globalsportmatters.com. The Global Sport Matters podcast is a production of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Our manager of marketing and communications is Crisal Valencia. Our manager of events and programs is Kendall Jones. And our digital communications specialist is me, Brendan Kleen. Our marketing and event assistants are Aiden Corrales, Natalie Skegan, and Kate Nelson. You can find and follow us on Twitter at Global Sport MTRS.